From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Many of us would quickly answer no if asked if state legislators deserve a pay raise. But we'll chat with a Duke University political scientist who suggests we might want to reconsider. Read the headlines and you might think members of the U.S. Senate spend all their time fighting partisan battles. North Carolina's junior senator explains why that's not so. Almost every building project in North Carolina requires some type of permit. You learn about legislation designed to make the permitting process more efficient. And we'll discuss the latest developments in the controversy surrounding the UNC Law School's Civil Rights Center and its ability to file lawsuits. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
A sound basic education. In 1997, the North Carolina Supreme Court ruled that every child has that right under the North Carolina Constitution. Two decades later, the Leandro case continues on, with the question still unresolved about exactly how to implement and measure that requirement. And now, Governor Roy Cooper has entered this story. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He has followed this case literally for years. He joins us now with the very latest. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's set the stage here. In 1994, we had five rural North Carolina school districts. They sued the state of North Carolina. Their contention was that they were lower-income counties, that they couldn't raise the kind of property tax revenue that wealthier counties could raise, and they felt that that put kids in those school districts at a distinct disadvantage. So they sued. Tell us what happened.
Well, they did sue, and initially the case was dismissed, but it came back with the North Carolina Supreme Court determining that there was some right to a sound basic education. Now, here's the interesting thing that happened. Typically, when the North Carolina Supreme Court would rule on a case, it would either go to a federal court or be over. But in this case, they remanded the case to the to a superior court, and specifically to Judge Howard Manning of the Superior Court. So in 1999, Judge Howard Manning had another series of hearings, and over the next 2 years published four memoranda that talked about in detail what this meant, what this idea of a sound basic education meant. And then in subsequent years, Judge Manning would call in folks from the Department of Public Instruction for testimony on whether the state was meeting that requirement.
And he would scold them and essentially say, you're not meeting that requirement.
That's right. And he would put staff of the Department of Public Instruction on the stand and ask some pointed questions about whether student performance, particularly in low-income and rural counties, was meeting his standards and the constitutional standards of a sound basic education.
Well, Terry, that phrase is really interesting, and apparently that's the nut of the issue here, how you interpret that phrase, what it really means. Is it about money that these counties somehow should have the state appropriating to them additional money, or is it about student achievement and effectiveness when you use money?
Judge Manning was adamant about the fact that it wasn't just about money. It was the quality of the staff, the principals, and the teachers that these counties were employing that was the real problem. And what he would do is he would compare the amount spent in one county compared to other counties and say, okay, you spend less than County X, but you're performing better. And so this is really about the quality of the staff. And he understood in a very basic level that it's the quality of the teacher, the quality of the principal, the quality of the staff in that school building that has the greatest effect on student achievement, not just about the amount of money that's spent. I mean, this case started out as an equity case, a case that would be about, are we spending enough, or is each system getting a certain amount of money? Should we equalize how much they get? And it went to an adequacy case. Are they getting an adequate amount of money? And Judge Manning said, yes, they are. They're just not using it in the right way.
Is this even resolvable if it comes to adequacy?
Well, here's the problem is that the plaintiffs don't want it to be resolved. Their ultimate goal, in my mind, is to have the courts force the state to increase the per pupil expenditure. This was the goal for a lot of these lawsuits that came out of the mid-1990s. I mean, we saw these lawsuits in many other states with the goal of trying to get the courts to compel states to throw more money at public schools. Now, not all states were willing to do that. And in fact, we see in some states today some of these cases that have come up where they are actually forcing the state to throw more money at public schools. North Carolina has been unwilling to do that, mostly because the judiciary has been very sensitive to the fact that it's the legislature and not the judiciary that determines where the money goes in North Carolina. And so there's a separation of powers issue that they haven't been willing to cross. But we have folks that want the state the judiciary to cross that line.
And now Governor Roy Cooper has created a commission. Well, tell us about that.
Well, the commission would be just a way to continue to get the state to try to get the state to increase the amount of money. I mean, he talks about resources. And when Governor Cooper talks about resources, he's talking about money. He's not talking about human resources. And so this is going to be a way to try to use the judicial system as a way to try to hammer the legislature into spending more money. And I think that is going to be the outcome of this group that he's putting together, is that's going to be their major recommendation. I can tell you right now that's going to be their major recommendation. Even without hearing or even knowing who's appointed to it, that's what they're going to recommend.
Now, meantime, an additional development that has come to the fore is that the parties in the lawsuit actually want a consultant brought in. What's that about?
Well, Judge Howard Manning has retired from the bench, and so there's been some talk about whether we could get a judge that would replace him that would have the kind of effect that he did on making sure that the constitutional requirement was being met. And so I think the idea now is that rather than looking at whether there is a judge on the bench that could take over for Manning, having a consultant come in and advise the court on what the court should do. Now, I'm really worried about having an outside consultant come in and do this because it begs a lot of questions. What kind of power will they have? Will the courts be compelled to follow through in what the consultant recommends? There's just a lot of unanswered questions about it. Plus, we're looking at consultants that may have a specific ideology that they're trying to advance. And if that's the case, then this is just going to be a setup to try to get the judges to order the state to spend more money.
Is it reasonable to think then that whatever comes out of the governor's commission and if this consultancy goes forward, that it's all going to end up at the door of the state legislature?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have seen increases in public school expenditures since the Republicans have been in charge. But, of course, that hasn't been satisfactory to the many public school advocacy groups out there that would like to see us contribute even more money to our public school system. So it's not about just increasing. It's about massive increases in public school expenditures to a level that is satisfactory to the advocacy groups, mainly those who benefit from more money going into the system, North Carolina Association of Educators and many other groups that have been pushing for the General Assembly to spend more money.
Terry, you said at the beginning it started as an equity case, and then it turned into an adequacy case. How do you determine, and who should determine, what is a, quote, adequate education?
Well, it's very arbitrary. And so, you know, that's really the danger of having the courts try to make this determination of what is an adequate amount of money. And we really don't have any good answer. Research doesn't give us much of a very good answer on what is an adequate amount of money. And we know that, you know, not all school systems are the same, and what may be adequate in one school system may not be adequate in another. And so to make a determination that the state has to hit one level or another is kind of silly.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should members of the North Carolina General Assembly get a pay raise? Before you answer with a resounding no, you might want to hear what our next guest has to say. Nicholas Carnes is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's studied the issue of how we pay our politicians. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
Before we get into this question of whether our legislators need a pay raise, let's remind people this isn't a full-time job now for North Carolina lawmakers. Tell us how we go about paying them now.
Absolutely. So the way we compensate legislators in North Carolina looks a lot like what most states do. And it's a little more complicated than it seems at first glance. We pay legislators a salary, but it's only about $13,000, $14,000, a little bit more for different positions. But the average legislator doesn't take home what most people would consider a full-time paycheck. Now, there are a couple of exceptions that are important for people to understand. We also give legislators a per diem to cover lodging and food, and we reimburse them for their travel so that legislators from the western part of the state aren't paying more to send to represent their constituents in Raleigh.
Or for the ones who are in the far eastern part of the state, too. They get a lot when they come to Raleigh.
Bingo.
As well.
When people converge on Raleigh, we don't want them paying more if they're from farther away.
Right. Exactly. So when we're talking about whether members of the General Assembly should get a pay raise, you have to take that existing system into account. So in looking at this issue from a scholarly perspective, how did you approach it?
Well, so I was really interested in one of the claims that proponents of pay raises for politicians make. And that is that the low pay in legislatures like North Carolina makes holding office really impossible for the average citizen of the state. And that was interesting to me because what I study primarily is the economic backgrounds or the economic diversity of our political institutions. And so this is a really exciting idea, I think. You know, we can just bump up the pay a little bit and we'll get a more representative mix of people coming to our General Assembly.
And so you had that as a proposition to test. What'd you find as you went forward?
Well, so one of the concerns I had going in was there's not actually any research that supports this claim. So when people tell you a pay raise for politicians will get you more economic diversity, they're basing it on good hunches and on intuition, but not on real data that would compare across states or across countries or anything like that. And so what I wanted to do in my research project was actually look at the data. Do states that pay their legislatures more have a more economically diverse mix of people?
And what'd you find?
Well, the surprise was that actually they don't. When a state pays more to people who hold office in the state legislature, the economic mix of people who actually go into the state legislature is about the same or maybe even a little more tilted towards affluent people. And the reason is that it's not really the pay that's keeping regular citizens from serving in the General Assembly or the state legislature in the first place. No matter how much you pay a politician for holding office, the thing to remember is everybody has to give up a lot of income when they run for office. There's no salary for being a candidate. And so, you know, that seems to be the bigger barrier that keeps people from throwing their hat into the ring. The way I compare it to, you know, it's sort of like if you told me I could get $100 if I win the Raleigh City of Oaks Marathon. I would say I can't do that. There's no way. I mean, I have to train for 100,000 hours. And then you tell me, well, what if I told you the prize was $10,000? I would say, well, that's fine, but I still can't do it. That's kind of the situation we find ourselves in when we think pay raises for politicians are going to give us a different mix of people. We have to remember that the thing that keeps most people out of office isn't the work of holding office itself, it's the work of being a candidate.
We are chatting with Nicholas Carnes. He is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. So back to the initial question that I asked at the top of the interview, should members of the North Carolina General Assembly get a pay raise? If I'm listening to what you're saying, it sounds to me that if your goal is to improve the economic diversity, get a lot of different views, then no, raising their pay isn't going to make much difference, at least based on what you've found.
That's right. But what it's important to keep in mind is there are other sort of good reasons to think carefully about legislative compensation. And so in my research, I also looked at other studies that have analyzed the differences between states that pay more and less. And there are actually big differences, not in who runs for office, but in how much effort they devote to the task. So in a state where the legislators aren't paid as much, they tend to miss more roll call votes. They tend to be sort of less concerned about keeping up with their constituents. And what I think that reflects is just a difference in the amount of their time and energy they're devoting to the task. And so it's always sort of struck me as puzzling that supporters of pay raises point to economic diversity as the reason to do it. I think a better argument is that states that pay their lawmakers more tend to get people who are focused more on the task of governing and representing constituents. And that may be, going forward, a better way for all of us to think about the complicated and thorny issue of how much to pay our politicians.
That's certainly an interesting piece to bring up, because you're right. The argument that you often hear for higher pay is it's hard to get people to come and serve in the General Assembly. So if we paid them more, we would get a different group, a different mix of people. But what you're focusing on in this last answer is the actual effort put toward the job, which a lot of us, regardless of what we want to pay the legislators, think should be their number one task, serving us as legislators.
That's right. Our lawmakers, we have to keep in mind they're people too. And we know that everybody has lots of different jobs. You know, we all have what we do for a living, but then we have our responsibilities to our families, to our communities. And it really looks like states that pay their legislators while they're in session as though it were a full-time job get people who focus on the task of governing as if it were a full-time job. And states that don't pay as much tend to get people for whom holding office is maybe takes a back seat to some of their other tasks.
I understand that as you've looked into this, you've also followed the specifics of the debate in North Carolina. What have you learned about how the approach in North Carolina has gone toward this idea of potentially raising pay?
So last February, Representative Pat Hurley from Randolph County introduced House Bill 71, a bill that wouldn't actually increase the salaries paid to the General Assembly, but would increase how much they're reimbursed for travel to and from to Raleigh and for meals and lodging while they're visiting the Capitol. And it's been remarkable how much criticism and heat that bill has taken from people in the general public. The headlines said, you know, politicians just want to pay themselves more. And that really elicits a powerful emotional and I think an understandable reaction from taxpayers when they hear that kind of narrative. I think it's important for people to pay very close attention, though, to the legislation that's on the table today, because the headline, politicians are giving themselves a pay raise, really masks some of the important nuances in the bill that's on the table, or that was on the table last February. But also, I think, should remind all of us how hard it is for politicians who care about setting the right pay for future legislators, how much heat they're going to take in the moment for doing that.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting topic, and we know one person who will be following it closely as North Carolina continues to debate this topic is Nicholas Carnes, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Duke University's Samford School of Public Policy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Think members of Congress spend all their time fighting each other over partisan issues? First-term Republican U.S. Senator Tom Tillis says that's not true. Tillis recently spoke to a North Carolina Bar Association meeting in Asheville. He recounted the story of Senate leaders asking him to serve on the Senate's highly contentious Judiciary Committee.
I remember thinking, sure, how hard could that be? I never served on committees in the majority when we took a majority because I was elected speaker. As a matter of fact, the first time I ever presided over a committee was just 3 months ago when I first presided over the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Personnel that I'm chair of. But I served in Judiciary in the minority, and I really enjoyed that committee. And then I thought, well, you know, I can do it up here. I had the same staff. Who asked me, you know, what I like most about being in Washington. They asked me what committee I like the most, and I said, I love Judiciary. And they said, why? I said, because it's hyper-partisan. And I said, I know that sounds odd, but But it's the committee. You know, if you're in Senate Armed Services and you're in veterans and you're in aging, even agriculture, you'd really have to work to go to those committees with a partisan edge, right? Because it's most of it's just good governance, and we can debate certain issues that come before Senate Armed Services, but they're fundamentally not. But if you think about it in Judiciary Committee, you are going to come in with your ideological worldview having a lot to do with what you take, you know, what you put forth. But what I love about that committee is the relationships you build with the members on the other side of the aisle. If you were to view our committees on C-SPAN, you would think that we all hated each other. But with Dick Durbin, I'm working on immigration reform that makes sense. With Al Franken, I'm working on mental health reform that makes sense. With Chris Coons, we're working on juvenile justice and sentencing reform that makes sense. With Sheldon Whitehouse, I can go down the list. Amy Klobuchar, about the only one that I haven't worked with, and it's because he doesn't focus as much on legislation because his leadership role is Senator Schumer. So we go in, not all of you, many of you are old enough to remember that old cartoon, Foghorn Leghorn, the rooster and the dog. They kind of walk in, they hit the time card, they go in. The whole cartoon's premised on this beating the tar out of each other for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And then the whistle blows, they go clock out and say, have a nice weekend. That really is how it happens in Judiciary Committee.
That's first-term U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina. He recently spoke to a room full of lawyers in Asheville. The topic? His service on the Senate's contentious Judiciary Committee. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Building almost anything in North Carolina requires government permits. A bill that has cleared the state house targets the permitting process, Republican State Representative Scott Stone explains.
The intent is to increase the efficiency of the permitting process in North Carolina and establish a reputation for our state as being one of the best places to do business and to build things and invest. One of the main goals is that everyone who's involved in the permitting process knows what the rules of the permitting process are, knows what the standards are. This bill does not set standards. It just makes sure that people are aware of the standards and the standards are actually adhered to. And it only relates to construction permitting for site construction. It's not building permits. One of the key elements is that it requires permitting to be done concurrently. Currently, right now, there's a lot of there are departments or state agencies that do them sequentially. For example, a lot of most jurisdictions, you get through the entire site plan process for permits, and then it goes to NCDOT. In this case, NCDOT would be doing them either concurrently or, in some cases, delegating the authority to the local municipalities. So there are 18 jurisdictions that would receive delegated authority from NCDOT to do the site permitting, and that is not unprecedented. It's been done for other types of permits. But NCDOT has been very involved in this process, and they support the language that's in the bill now.
How much would this bill cost?
It is a nominal amount that is reflected in there, and that is related to what NCDOT believes would be the cost of associated with reviewing other towns and cities that are not part of the initial review. Given that initial delegation, this would be for reviewing their essentially their applications if they want to add on. Now, what this, I don't think what this does reflect, though, is the potential cost savings that would come with this that comes from the staff right now from NCDOT that is involved in these reviews in the local towns and cities who wouldn't be doing them now in the future. They're doing them now. They wouldn't be doing them in the future because they wouldn't have that authority anymore because they'd be delegating that authority to others. So it's really a way to add efficiency to the process, and I think it's probably either a wash, if not a cost savings potentially.
What about new fees?
The intent of the fees is to allow the cities and towns, if there is an increase in cost to them to implement a program or to implement an online permitting program, which some cities and towns already have. If they have that process, they can implement a fee to cover that. But it has to be directly related to the fee. The fee has to be directly related to the cost of that program. What we want to make sure in this bill that they don't have a program, they say, well, this is going to cost us all this extra money, so we have to have a huge extra fee, and it just becomes a hidden impact fee. This, we wanted to set it to only the amounts that are actually impacting the cost. It has to be a direct cost to it. The fees essentially pay for themselves. It is a user fee, and I would say that the users of this are going to be very excited because it's going to cut the permitting time, sometimes weeks, if not months, from the time they submit their application to the time they get their permit. So the user fee will be very nominal, but it should be a wash from all the other costs.
That's State Representative Scott Stone. He's explaining his bill to streamline the construction permitting process in North Carolina. Colleague Bill Brawley had some questions for Stone.
It delegates to cities larger than 50,000
yes.
permit approval for DOT-maintained roads. And I was wondering to what extent the cities have the ability to bind DOT to expend money for road improvements as part of this.
This is essentially primarily private development is what this would be for in the permits that are encroaching on the right-of-way, for example. This would not be any changes to the roadways themselves. This would be essentially, and they would have to meet NCDOT standards. The key of this is NCDOT gets to set the standards for any state-maintained roads, and the local municipality has to ensure that they meet those standards in their review. So it does not relieve NCDOT from any of the maintenance obligations that they would already have. What it does is it just takes one layer of review out of the process. So there is no state projects or federal projects or projects that the city themselves are doing can be given as delegated authority.
Brawley had another question for Stone.
Is there a way of enforcing or correcting the overstep when the cities begin to do things that they're not delegated to do?
There is a provision that says that the cities cannot go beyond what the state standard is, because I know sometimes we've had that problem where the cities take the opportunity and they go beyond what they were authorized to do. This bill specifically states that the cities cannot go beyond the standard, and so that should help. But there's also NCDOT has a review provision in here where they can monitor the cities to see, make sure they're implementing the program as it was intended. The language of a lot of those elements of the delegated authority came out from, I think some of it was identical to language that was in a bill from the 1970s called the Sedimentation Control Act, where DEQ essentially delegates authority to certain cities and towns and counties for stormwater permits and erosion control permits. So the language is very similar to that.
Brawley also shared concerns about local governments raising their own permitting fees.
It says that a municipality may establish a fee for review of a transportation-related or right-of-way as limited by provisions of the general statutes, but it also says if the local government already reviews construction plans, it may not establish an additional fee. So do I read this correctly to say that the cities can't raise fees and say the state made them do it?
If, for example, CDOT in the city of Charlotte or Raleigh DOT in Raleigh is already looking at a set of plans and they've already got a transportation engineer looking at a roadway, and then they've got the delegated authority, they're already having someone look at that set of plans for the same sets of standards and so forth, it's really no extra work to look at it on behalf of the state as well. So if there is an actual additional burden to them, that's one thing. But a lot of times they've already got someone looking at it anyway, so we don't need to have an extra fee just to say, oh, you know, count it twice. We don't want them double counting.
Democratic State Representative Greg Meyer asked about the potential impact for environmental regulators.
Does DEQ have a role in any of this permitting as well? I mean, do they have to do some environmental studies, and would they be impacted by this, or is there an impact on DEQ's role?
There's no impact to DEQ's role. In fact, it says there is a provision in this language that says nothing in this bill shall impact DEQ's role or their delegated authority they already give to cities and towns. The intent is not to have an impact to them. The only impact to them would be it does establish in the end of the bill, there's a provision that says that DEQ and DOT have to establish an online permitting system for their reviews, but I think it's 2020 is the effective date, so it's pretty far out there.
Democrat Deb Butler offered her own assessment of the Republican-sponsored bill.
This bill does a good job in compelling our cities and counties not necessarily to reduce their standards or change their standards, but to at least clearly identify the standards so that at least a developer knows what the rules of the road are. So I think that that is terrific. And it also seems to set some reporting standards. So in other words, let's move it on down the road.
That's correct. At no point in this bill does it set standards or the schedule. What we do require is that every jurisdiction, whether they're being delegated authority or not, every jurisdiction has to have a schedule for reviews. And whether that's each review cycle's 15 days, 30 days, 6 months, whatever it is, they can set that. But it has to be published, it has to be approved by that local governing board, and then quarterly they have to report it, how are we doing? Because you could say you're doing it 30 days, but if you're really taking 6 months, then you're not being very transparent and honest. So you're right, it's not to set standards, to make sure everyone knows the rules.
You've been listening to debate about a bill dubbed the Permitting Efficiency Act. It has cleared the State House and remains alive in the State Senate. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A committee of the UNC Board of Governors has recommended that the UNC Center for Civil Rights be prohibited from filing lawsuits. Now, this recommendation has proved controversial. Carrie Travis is associate editor of Carolina Journal. She was actually in that committee meeting room for the discussion and the vote. She's been following the arguments for several months now, joining us to let us know what's happening. Carrie, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, what does the UNC Center for Civil Rights actually do?
So the Center for Civil Rights has a couple of different purposes at this point. One is they do academic research, which means that they look at cases, they do studies, they make policy recommendations, that type of thing. The other aspect of their work is the more controversial one, which is entering into lawsuits and actually representing clients in court. And it's a lot of pro bono work for low-income and minority cases, so that type of thing.
What has been the concern by some of the members of the Board of Governors?
The central concern is that the center is not a law clinic. And just to boil down in rough terms, a law clinic is a type of program that is actually licensed under the American Bar Association to practice law. The clinic would be more acceptable to the Board of Governors, that model, but the Center for Civil Rights is a research organization that's attached to the university. It carries the name of the UNC Law School, and it is essentially suing state, city, and county entities, which the board is kind of looking at this and saying, why is a state-owned and operated organization that's not a law clinic suing the state?
Interesting. So taxpayers on the one hand helping to fund this organization through UNC.
Well, this is where it gets a little complicated. So the center claims that they have 100% of their funding from private donors and foundations that they go solicit on their own. However, they still operate with functions attached to the university. So there are questions about, like, what about their human resources? They're still carrying the weight of the name. All of the attorneys that are actually working at the center with the students are UNC professors. So they're not necessarily technically run by taxpayer money, but there's still enough of that attachment by name and association to money funneled through the UNC system.
So that's gotten some members of the Board of Governors a little bit perturbed, I think is fair to say.
Accurate, yes.
Yeah, one in particular proposed doing some things with this center. Mm-hmm. There were several options that were up for discussion. You were in that room. Tell mm-hmm. us what happened.
So Steve Long, who is a member of the Board of Governors, is an attorney here in Raleigh. He's the one who brought forward the proposal to ban the center from entering into lawsuits. So they wouldn't be able to represent clients in court. They wouldn't be able to essentially attach themselves to cases that are being represented by other law firms. They would be solely restricted to their research pursuits.
Which sounds like actually their written mission, it being a research organization.
Yes. And that has been the main argument presented by the Board of Governors, that they are designed to be a research organization, that they should not be suing the state, city, and county entities that they formerly have been. So the proposal that was put forth in that meeting only applies to banning litigation for academic research centers. It won't cover law clinics. Law clinics in the UNC system will still be able to operate in their full function. Students will be able to go in the court and represent cases and make arguments under the American Bar Association rules in those law clinics. Now, on the counter side, you have the members and staffers of the center who are very upset about this.
Understandably so.
Because what they're doing now is less heavy-handed on the research side and more heavy-handed on the litigation side. And that's where a lot of their funding apparently comes from. They made that argument. And the executive director of the center, Ted Shaw, threw out a few choice names for Governor Stephen Long, which one of them was calling him a moving assassin towards the center.
It got pretty heated during that discussion as that vote was about to take place. No, fair to say, no love lost between those two folks.
Absolutely none. I talked to Mr. Long after the meeting and asked him for a reaction to that moving assassin quote, and he paused for a long moment and then said that it was very unprofessional and pretty upsetting.
Now, regardless of how the debate went, then it was time for the vote, and this thing passed overwhelmingly out of this committee.
It did. There was a bit of a surprise with the chair of the committee, who's Board of Governors member Anna Nelson, voting no against it, but it passed 5-1 out of the committee. One abstention from the vote, Mr. Darrell Allison, who is a newcomer to the board, and this thing will probably go before the entire board in September.
So, Carrie, UNC Chancellor Carol Folt also made some comments about this, and you reported on her comments as well. She was concerned about this upcoming vote, and now this has gone on. It'll go to the full Board of Governors. What were her comments?
Her comments were that this will tarnish the reputation of the university. She has received hundreds of letters to her account from university faculty, administrators, presidents, chancellors from around the nation. She is concerned about civil rights education for law students as well. And one of her other arguments was that as far as the future of that training for students, she's not quite sure what the university is going to do to provide that civil rights law experience. So she's worried about this on a few different fronts. Now, I spoke with Board of Governors member Marty Kotis after that meeting, and he stated very clearly that there is a civil rights legal clinic at the UNC Law School that handles those type of cases. And he also stated that if she's worried about the tarnished reputation of the university, then they should also think about the big lawsuits regarding the NCAA that are also the lawsuit that's potentially going to happen.
More interesting comments.
Yes.
What about the head of the entire system, Margaret Spellings? I know you've developed a relationship with, mm-hmm. with her and that you've reported on her a number of times. Has she said anything about all this?
She released a statement following the meeting and was very diplomatic, is the best way to sum up her statement. She's taking a stand for civil rights law and the importance of that education, but she did not release much comment as far as her actual position on the closing of the legal aspect of the clinic, or the center, rather.
What's so interesting about this, I think, and it was brought out in your reporting, Carrie, is that not only is there a legitimate discussion over what should this organization be doing and structurally, you know, where should it exist and all that, but it seemed to kind of illustrate that the Board of Governors has been changing mm-hmm. over the last several years, mm-hmm. and there seem to be people who are not comfortable with some of the members and some of their perspective on things.
That is fairly accurate. We have a predominantly conservative board. The members of the faculty and students of the UNC schools are predominantly liberal, I think is a safe summary to say. So we're seeing, again, some conflict between those two ideologies as we look at these conversations. And Long has said repeatedly this is not an ideological discussion. The left-leaning center is not being shut down because of its political views.
Well, it's a really a fascinating story, and we've been talking with Carrie Travis. She is the reporter on this story, associate editor at Carolina Journal. You can read it at carolinajournal.com. Headline, UNC Board Poised to Ban Some Lawsuits by Center for Civil Rights. Carrie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.